and welcome to How To Medieval, the how-to where two guys show you how to do it between the two of them. My name is Ari.
And I'm Matt.
And today we're going to talk about color, especially in regards to clothing. Now, Matt, I understand this was inspired in the last couple days. So what happened to make you think about today's episode?
I was reading stuff online, as I often do, and
a dangerous activity.
And it was conversations about clothing and also medieval movies and things like that. And it brought me back to the idea of, you know, you talking about how modern medieval movies are always done with that sort of browns and grays, and it's done through a blue filter. And there's a lot of chatter going on around color, the use of color in all reenactment, but specifically medieval reenactment. And there's a lot of misinformation being thrown about the use of color. You know, we all know, you know, harking back to other conversations we've had, you know, medieval movies, like, they put people in browns and they put them in grays, maybe a light blue. And I remember talking about when,
this is even like an old trope. I was looking for movies yesterday because we had kind of like a mini at home date night, and we were looking for an actual like movie to watch instead of some of the shows that we go through. And while thumbing through, I found this show on Netflix called A Letter to the King. And
I've heard of A Letter to the King. Yes.
And I watched the preview, and the preview on Netflix is like this bar brawl that starts for no particular reason. I'm guessing that there's context clues if you actually watch the show. And not a single person is wearing something that isn't brown leather. Everyone is wearing some sort of burlappy, brown leather, dark, ugly, dirty, filthy clothing. And so this trope is not like one that we're complaining about that has long since been fixed. This is still today. New shows are coming out looking ugly.
Well, and I remember how when we were talking about the movie Gawain and the Green Knight, how, you know, and while it's not strictly medieval, but how pleasantly surprised we both were with the use of certain colors that really, you know, stuck out and brightened up a bit, like his yellow cloak really standing out in that bright yellow. And then talk about how that was actually dyed and using natural dyeing techniques to get that color. So I mean, we know that medieval clothes had color. We see it in the manuscripts. We see it in paintings and manuscripts, in written descriptions of what people are wearing. We know that they had color, and the use of color was prevalent. And a lot of times, medieval reenactors first starting out, and media people trying to portray medieval people and putting them in the dark colors like black and everything, they miss the entire historical aspect of it, that, you know, no, not everybody in medieval times wore black, because black was actually really hard to make and a very expensive color. And there were less expensive colors that were much brighter in hue that were worn.
Oh, yeah. And what you're talking about before about the actual medieval materials, the dyes that were used to make Gawain's cloak in the Green Knight movie, that's one of those things that leads to a much more exciting color palette than modern movie tropes give it credit for, because, as you said, the darker colors, the like deep jewel tones, were more difficult to produce, which is why you see them on higher status impressions. You know, the people in the paintings who were the kings and the nobles had these really deep colors because they were able to afford them, and they were able to afford newer clothing because those kinds of dyes would not last as long. They would bleach out, well, not using bleach, but they would tend to fade quicker. And so you have this incredibly rich palette of pastels and bright light colors. And you think about like prairie calicos, not the prints, but like those softer colors that you get. And so the wider range of color choices that medieval people had access to, even the poor had access to, was so vibrant compared to what we give them credit for. It's just there's so much out there to choose from. So if you want to indulge in color, you really can.
And so the Rosalie's Medieval Woman, who we've talked about before, we should try to get her on sometime, see if she'd be interested to come on.
Oh, yeah.
But her blog, which is rosaliegilbert.com, actually has a great breakdown of medieval dye stuffs and dyeing and color names. And it's amazing all the different colors they could get out of these natural materials. There's another group called the Company of the Staple. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure where they're located, but
they're in Australia.
They're in Australia. Okay. They have another great page talking about dyeing and the different colors. And they have a great photo of their group standing. And there's just all, it's a rainbow. It's a rainbow of colors going, you know, there's brilliant yellows and oranges. There's bright jewel tone blues. There's more grayer blues. There's bright greens. There's grays and browns. It's really fantastic, the portrayals that they're putting out there with colors, because it looks more like a miniature manuscript miniature painting having all those colors than everybody being in even just like natural colors.
Right. And of course, out in Sydney, it's so hot, they need those lighter colors or they'll all die.
Yeah.
So another one who does really good videos on dyeing, as she did a run of them, was Eel for the Red. Now she focuses on a lot earlier eras because she does the Irish Viking as her personal impression, but she does a number of really good video tutorials. They're still on her channel, obviously, on dyeing as well, especially when it comes to like practicing with what you can get fasted and certain types of matter and stuff like that. These are all words that I can throw around, even though if I only tangentially understand how they work.
So what we're trying to get to is don't be afraid to throw some color into the works when you're putting your kit together. But it all depends, of course, on the status you're trying to portray. Higher end status people get to have the brighter colors for a number of reasons. One, because they could afford to do it. They could afford those really bright jewel tones. Two, we know that there was a knockoff clothing industry in medieval times. So basically, the rich people would set, just like today, the rich and famous would set the style trends, and it would trickle down through the social strata. And you always had people, especially in places where there was a little more leeway for them to do so, trying to emulate that higher socioeconomic level. Yeah, we've all seen the knockoff Coach bags sold in the stalls in New York City. You know, we all see the knockoff brands on Amazon that look almost exactly like the real brand, but they're just different enough that, you know, that you can tell that they're not the real brand. So this isn't something that's modern. The idea of selling knockoff clothes isn't something that's modern, but instead of having, like, you know, brand names, you are having knockoff clothing colors. So instead of getting that really bright jewel tone blue, you might have had a little more faded blue that was sort of close to it, but not quite.
It's the whole idea of, you know, buying the real thing or then what you get off Wish.
Exactly. Exactly. It's the medieval wish. You know, it's just not really quite the same, but it's close enough where if people look at you quick, they wouldn't necessarily notice the difference.
Or more importantly, if you're thinking about why someone would want something like this, if you're wandering through the market on, you know, you make you're one of four trips to the major market every year, and you're wandering through the crowds, you know, most of the people aren't going to get close enough to notice that it's not quite right. You're just going to be one of those, you look a little fancier in the crowd type of people. Or if, say, you know, you're lining up with a bunch of other people for some sort of event or some sort of muster, or some sort of reason to be not personally inspected, but part of like an entourage, you'll look good enough. It's almost like the 6-foot rule that we use for authenticity, but for social interaction.
And especially during the time after the Black Plague, not directly after, but in that sort of rebuilding era afterwards, where you start to see a greater amount of economic movement within that sort of middle class, the yeoman class or the burgher class, Andrew, the modern medieval man would popular Urbana would call what he studies. They are trying to emulate that upper tier because they want to be seen, especially like the burghers, they want to be seen as people who were of that higher social economic class. So you do get, like I said, these knockoff collars. One of the most famous knockoff collars is a collar that has a lot of myth around it. Can you guess what it is, Ari?
I think you're talking about purpur.
The color purple, not the award-winning novel and movie starring Whoopi Goldberg, but the actual color purple.
Such a storied history with purple.
There is such a storied history with purple. And there's a lot of telephone game myths that follow purple. And that the biggest one of them is, and I think you know what it is.
That who it didn't only exist?
Well, I've never heard that. I've never heard that the color purple didn't exist.
Well, from the perspective of anybody, it's like the whole, it's the ermine phenomenon, where the idea that this only existed for like the 17 people on the planet who are allowed to afford it.
Basically, the myth that it was only allowed use by royalty. Now, I can hear some people, our listeners, some of our very educated listeners out there going, but there's, you know, we've read these mandates. It's like Elizabeth had a mandate saying, you know, this, and then the Romans had mandates. Like, yes, there were some sumptuary law mandates, sumptuary laws being laws about what people can wear or use or look like outside of their social station. But here's the thing about sumptuary laws. While we know that some of them existed, we don't really know how well they were enforced. And especially once you get into that upper tier yeomanry or burgher class, when you start to have money, the fine you're imposed on, should you be caught doing it, really isn't enough to deter you from doing it.
Well, especially in regards to when you're talking about even above, like if you, those people who are non-noble that break through that, the middle class, and you're talking about like the patrician level type of social network, there are people out there where the fines that were listed were just not, they're not a deterrent. It's kind of the idea that, you know, they say speeding is a crime that is enforced almost entirely by fine. Same thing with parking and things like that, which means that it's really only a deterrent to people who can't afford the ticket. And so there's a joke out there about the rich guy who parked his fancy car in the no parking zone of outside the club, and they go in and the people he's meeting is like, hey, you're gonna get like a $60 ticket for parking there. You don't want to park there. And he's like, no, it just means that it costs me $60 to park there. Who cares? And so it really depends on who you are as to whether or not a fine is really that big a deal. I mean, we see this a lot of times in big corporations where the EPA fines for doing bad things are just kind of part of the budget, right? That's what you budget.
Rounding error. It's a rounding error.
Right? It's part of the materiality of doing this particular business. Otherwise, it would be too expensive. You know, the fine is cheaper than doing it the right way. But you see this a lot of times. Also, there's something to be said for the fact that the laws were put into place because people were doing things, not because they weren't. We don't write laws about the things that human beings aren't doing to each other or aren't doing in society that we object to. Laws are written after someone does something. It's the joke. Where's the joke? You go to you get a new job and you go through the policy manual. And the joke is that every one of those rules has some old employee's name behind it, right?
Yeah, every rule has a name. Yeah,
exactly. So someone did something the king didn't like, so that's why there's a law, right? And that's the same thing with sumptuary laws, which means that if you are reenacting the 5 years prior to the establishment of our most popular sumptuary laws in England, that means that a ton of people were doing the things that were expressly prohibited in the sumptuary laws, because otherwise they wouldn't have written those laws in the first place to stop people from doing the things they didn't like them doing. So to say that there was these sumptuary laws so no one ever was allowed to upon beheading, like, that's insane. Like, people were doing them all the time, and they were probably doing them long after the sumptuary laws, because it just worked for them to deal with being a rakish outlaw when it came to clothing.
That's exactly right. I mean, it's they got far more pleasure out of wearing the fancy clothes than it was worth to, you know, like you said, it was like, oh, that the parking just cost $60. I mean, it's like this doublet, you know, well, how much did it cost you from the tailor? It cost me this, but if you add in the fine, it really cost me, you know, $120 or something like that.
Exactly. So some of the fancier clothing you only wear for special events, almost flaunting what you're doing, you know? And I realize that there's a lot of supposition in this line of thinking that we've addressed periodically about flaunting, but I mean, there's clear evidence that people were doing things intentionally to snub their nose at the upper class, especially at the fall of feudalism.
And especially when you look around, like, the sumptuary laws in England around Elizabeth and that color purple, as I was talking about before, which there was a law. Again, how well it was enforced or followed, it's hard to say, but it really was a case of the old rich trying to stop the new rich from looking like them, because people suddenly had the money to purchase these expensive clothes, and the old rich didn't like it because they liked being set apart from the others. You know, they liked being special. So they tried to make these laws to still set themselves apart. And as we all know, since no sumptuary laws don't really exist today, they didn't really stick. So you know, the color purple, there is some truth to the color purple being used for royalty. The was a very specific color purple called Tyrian purple. And Tyrian purple was made from a specific, very rare, I believe, shellfish. Yeah, sea snails. Predatory sea snails. And they only were like from the Mediterranean. Very hard to get. So it made it very, very expensive. It was very, very difficult to make. So that specific color purple was probably restricted to royalty in the upper class, because only they could afford to get it. But we know that they found other ways to make the color purple that weren't as expensive. It wasn't quite the same purple as the Tyrian purple, but it was close enough, and it was still purple, and people still wore purple. So
because it wasn't all purple was prohibited either. It was just exactly the one purple that used to be exclusive to the queen that other people could now start buying, and jealousy and frustration of the erosion of the clear divide between who was and wasn't nobility. That's all it was about. It was a pissing contest. It wasn't that the color purple had to have been banned from society, period.
So a fun thing to do, if you're ever out and about in your gear and it's purple, anybody, you know, says, oh, you're not supposed to be wearing purple, only royals wear purple, you sort of put a thumb to your, you know, finger to your side of your nose and wink at them like, shh, don't tell anybody.
That's right. Or ask them for their color swatches to prove that you have Tyrian purple.
Purple.
Yeah.
Or be like, oh, all right, you got me. Who do I pay the fine to?
Checks in the mail, guys.
It's like, what, two silver? Fine.
I don't know. I was going to say, silver is pretty expensive right now. I don't know if I can afford to spend two silver every event I go to.
It's like so expensive to park my horse here.
Yeah.
We also know that there were patterns and woven patterns especially in the later medieval period, in the fabrics, we see them on in artwork all throughout, you know, Europe, starting around the mid 1300s, moving forward. So again, patterned material, whether it be like a printed or a brocade or a woven fabric, probably would have been a little more expensive. Brocades definitely would have been more expensive than just the regular plain dyed stuff. But there's a weird cutoff, because we do know earlier periods didn't like showing off like woven fat. They liked like the flat weave in their fabrics. They didn't like the different contrasting weaves and things like that to make stuff show up. So that's going to show up in the, you know, things like a plaid weave or a herringbone or a houndstooth or a lampas or something like that.
Gwen has a really good article on mottled or heathered, like motley fabric in the Middle Ages and sort of its ties to the middle class. The idea that you're using half as much of the more expensive colored fabrics, and the other half is the plainer, less well dyed, and so you cut the cost while still getting some of the color, kind of thing. And that it was it's a really good article. I will link to that as well as all the other people we've mentioned. But things like, I like that a good herringbone pattern existed, which means you could effectively make your frumpy tweed suit for a clerical impression out of a, like, you know, Herjolfsness gown if you do the right material. And it just entertains me, like, on a completely side note, that it just tickles me that you could do your frumpy English professor kind of look in the medieval context and it's entirely authentic.
There's another great blog online called Postage Stew, or Postage and Stews. It's history of history, food, and cooking. It's a person named Sidsel Pedersen, or Peterson, from Denmark, runs this, and they have a really great breakdown of the colors and the weaves and fabrics used on their blog too. And we'll link to that too, because it's really, really interesting. So, yeah, so colors, don't be afraid to use colors in your impressions, especially for, you know, upper tier impressions, and especially for sort of your civvies too. We do have, in manuscripts, they do show that color was used in martial garments as well. So, long story short, the Middle Ages was colorful, and we need to break this trope of reenactors and movies and things like that of it being these brown on brown on grays and way too much black.
Oh yeah, way too much black. Now, we've talked about this before in our episode on making targeted impressions, specifically impressions of people who are like foresters and hunters and wilderness folk, is that they had a clearly established use of color, both to, you know, the greens to establish that you know to kind of camouflage, but also I really like your interpretation that, you know, you see this green and red theme a lot, and so this green tunic and then red hosen as possibly like hunter orange kind of concept, wherein the majority of your body you've disguised as the foliage, but there's just enough color out there, even if they didn't quite understand to the biological degree that we do about the ability for animals to see certain colors, that, you know, I'm less likely to crossbow my friend if he's wearing something I can see, but it doesn't seem to stop the deer from not noticing me, kind of thing. And so we see this use of color both as coding, like you were saying, but also as, if nothing else, kind of like a protection, like personal safety, in the same way that we use color in that similar way now.
That's right. I was just reading a quick through a couple of these blogs and got a little distracted. But yeah, specific colors were did have specific uses, like the green in hunting or the red. You know, red was actually one of the less expensive colors to make. So you do see a lot of reds, especially in the mid and lower mid classes. The peasant class tended to use a little more muted colors, but not quite as much as everyone would want us to believe. One of the next, I mean, so that's something I was just reading on Rosalie's Medieval Woman, where she was talking about how, while I say go out and use color and that there should be more color, it doesn't necessarily mean that these colors were instantly adopted by all walks of life. So there were certainly probably specific colors used in specific industries. There were probably specific colors used in specific classes for anything. I mean, just barring the financial ability to buy those colors. There are specific fabrics definitely used in different classes and different professions. The clergy used a lot of their own different types of fabrics, like the cloth of gold and things like that. So definitely when you're building your impression and you're looking for the fabric to use and looking for the color of fabric to use, think about what best fits your station and the use of the clothing. That'll get you the more bang for your buck. And there's a whole other conversation of what, you know, what colors, what types of fabric were actually dyed certain colors. We know that linen doesn't hold natural dyes that well. Certain colors it holds better. It holds blue fairly well. Red did not hold that well. Green it did not hold that well. I don't really know why, what the science behind that is, but we just know it didn't happen. So.
It
wasn't what?
Mad enough.
Mad enough.
I think it's matter that makes things hold faster. Like you get darker colors out of more matter. So I always liked in my head, whenever I see paler colors, I was like, oh, that the dyer just wasn't mad enough.
We need to.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
So something to think about.
I was going to say, before you get going, sidetrack for no here, my 8-year-old son has started telling jokes, started making up his own jokes, and I've had to pull him aside a number of times and be like, dude, if you have to explain it, it's not funny.
Some people still need that reminder.
They do. I do every day. All right. What you got me
thinking about with the science of things, I think there's a disclaimer that we kind of probably should acknowledge at some point today is that we're also talking about the medieval era. And so as the medieval era is a millennium long, we have to remind people that there will be a ton of variations in the things we're talking about because the availability of certain materials, access to certain techniques changed over time. And then of course, cultural impression and taste and style change over time. So there will be plenty of eras wherein things were possible, but probably not seen as popular because they had fallen out of fashion. And we see this today, that fashion comes and goes, and that there are certain patterns and prints that we wore in the 90s, and we all don't collectively know why, because they just don't look good now. And
we don't talk about them.
We don't talk about them. It's just like Bruno. So that one will age very about as well. So... yeah, just to throw that out there, talking about the science of things, you know, they did get better at doing them over time, but there will be differences throughout time on what they were able to do, and especially as the ability to access certain materials ebbed and waned, and social certain cultures would have access to more or less of a certain material than others at certain times. So keep that in mind, that these vague general concepts we're talking about, though they are fairly enduring across the medieval era, will always require a little more research on your part to nail down exactly what fits your impression.
That's right.
But also use color in your impression anyway.
Yes, I don't want to see anybody out there in just brown. Right. Come on, unless you're a monk.
Well, yeah. I mean, even then, the monks were not universal in that. You had
No, that's true.
You had the gray monks in in England. The Grey Friars. Yeah, and then there was ones who wore only white, and so
Black Friars.
Yep. But brown is typically like an all universal brown is very much a Franciscan friar thing. Which then, of course, the Franciscan order wasn't even like a something that was around for all of the medieval era either. So again, nuance abides.
There's nuance abides. I like the dude abides. Nuance abides. I like nuance abides.
I wasn't intentionally making a reference to that movie, but it does fit.
So, and that's something to look at, especially when you're picking out colors for your impression and you start looking at manuscripts and things like that. We've talked about manuscripts before, about how you need to be careful that you're looking at what's actually being depicted and not symbolism for something else. So you always be careful of that too, but manuscripts are great. There's also that conversation, you know, looking at manuscripts is like, did the manuscripts colors themselves fade? Because there's that great discussion about the color pink in medieval clothes. And there are multiple manuscript images that depict basically the color pink. And the question is, well, what is it depicting? Is it actually depicting them meaning to dye something pink? Because you can, using different plants, get the color pink naturally. But is that what's being depicted? Or is it just that it's being that a lower class person had something red that was faded? Or is it that the manuscript itself has actually faded? So there's a lot of moving parts within that to try to figure it out. I am actually in the camp of, I think that they had some form of pink that they did use, because you see manuscripts where you have bright, bright reds being shown next to lighter pinks, and they're all the same sort of class of people, but they're wearing the different colors. So that's what leads me to believe that pink was actually a color done on purpose for a number of times.
Well, I don't have
the
citation on me, but I'm trying to remember where I read this, but I'm pretty sure I read something that indicated that it was a written description of where a color of someone's clothing or an article of clothing was sort of compared to that of a salmon. And so that has to be pink if you're talking, I mean, it's that or it's an ugly gray color, right?
So wait. So you're telling me that even in medieval times, someone was like, hey, bro, nice pink shirt. And like, dude, it's not pink, it's salmon. You never heard that one before?
I'm not quite sure I get the reference.
The reference of basically macho guys going, I don't wear pink. It's not pink. It's salmon.
Oh. I mean, I guess check your ego. I don't know. Like, there's nothing wrong with wearing pink, but no, I don't. I don't remember where I got that from, though.
I can say, though, there was that, you know, to make a better joke, there was a, because that joke, what I just did was not funny at all.
I mean, I'm sure it's funny to somebody else. I just don't get it. I just didn't.
So to make a better joke, there's the, you know, it's like, what is it? Somebody talking to a salmon that's like, oh, salmon, we love you so much. We named a color after you. The salmon's like, oh, is it this beautiful, like sparkling iridescent gray? And it's like, actually,
see, that one's fun. I like that.
Why is it pink?
Oh, no. Oh, the tragedy. So,
I could see that description being made about something. But I see a lot of manuscript images where it's definitely more of a pink, like a flower, like a rose pink or something like that. So I really think, and it's something almost universally shown being worn by both men and women. So it was just a nice color.
I think it'd be interesting to actually go through a manuscript where someone is suggesting that the pink on the clothing is just faded, and seeing if that same manuscript also contains other depictions of pink where the pink would be more applicable, such as, like you said, a flower, and to really give an impressionist. So if there was enough time passed where a red would turn pink, then wouldn't a pink have had the same opportunity to wash out to an off-white?
I'm looking at a miniature right now from the Bedford Hours, and it's circa 1410 to 1430. And it shows a number of men, obviously of upper class, because they're wearing, they're wearing coats that have like gold embroidery done on them, on the sleeves and on the hems. They're wearing hoods, some of them in chaperones, some of them just hoods that have embroidery on them. One of them has a long cape that has embroidery on it. And there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 men that you can see. One of them is wearing a bright, bright red cloak. There's a darker red chaperon and a darker red hat in the background. And then there's a guy wearing a lighter pink hood and a pink coat. So to me, that seems like that's done on purpose. It isn't the colors faded. That was purposely done to show that they're wearing pink.
Yeah, there's no way that the color would have faded to pink if there's other colors. I mean, I guess you could make, just to argue the opposite side of it, you could say that perhaps the pink item of clothing was painted with a different shade of red, and that other shade of red pigment faded, whereas the pigments used to do a contrasting red color from the other people's costumes did not. However, when you explain it like that, there's a lot of extra moving parts, and if we're going to use the best conclusion without some other evidence to show that there was multiple colors of pigments used there, it is most reasonable to conclude that it was intended to be pink.
I'm really a big fan of Occam's razor here, where sometimes the most simplest explanation is the explanation.
And the simplest explanation here is that they wore pink, and there's nothing wrong with that.
Exactly. And these are one of these guys. They show him wearing gray hair. He's not a young dude. He's an old dude. So, I mean, it's like it was worn by both men and women. So let's see some pink on the field.
Well, yeah, and to further argue against the modern macho sensibility that we were discussing earlier is that, I mean, you look at like 12th century clothing, and there isn't functionally much difference between the dresses for women and the robes for men. It's really semantics to give them different names, because you're effectively wearing a knee-length garment. It's an extended t-shirt. Men and women wore the exact same thing, more or less. And while I'm certain there are, nuance abides, I'm certain there are slight differences, possibly even slight differences between how they were cut for men and women, they are essentially both dresses. And
yeah, that's true.
Dudes who won wars and could take on swaths of peasants would wear these pink dresses, and it's perfectly okay. And so to say that it is impossible for someone in the past to have worn pink because currently you're uncomfortable wearing the color pink is a little frustrating to hear.
Well, and that goes to take a little jaunt in the time machine, past medieval into more modern era. In the early 19th, early 20th century, pink was designated a boy's color, as it was considered to be too hot of a color for the temperament of a young girl. So
very masculine.
So, and I'm looking at another miniature here from Christian de Pizan's work, dated 1413. I think it has something to do with the War of the Roses era, because I'm seeing they're in a garden and there's white roses on one side and red roses on the other, and the guy's wearing this gorgeous red, gold-lined, red, hooplined, fur-trimmed. He's got embroidery on the sleeve, and he's got a pink sash slung over his shoulder. And it's obviously not faded. It's a completely different color. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I'm standing with my breakdown on this.
Well, pink, that's an interesting contrast to the conversation And we're talking about color in manuscripts, so it still sort of applies to this conversation. But it's an interesting contrast to, there's a lot of talk about the whole blackened armor issue when it comes to...
I was going
to
mention that.
Yeah. And so we see here where there's clearly, it's the colors have held fast. And then in that conversation, there's that artifact of error is introduced when the silver tinctures used to make actual like shiny silver effects on page tarnish into black, because that's how silver tarnishes. And so you get this, you know, you have this, it's reasonable to worry that there might be fading or distortion in color over time, because we do have to wrangle with that very problem in certain manuscripts. However, that doesn't mean that every manuscript ever has colors which have faded so that they are no longer an accurate representation of what might have been seen on the page at the time that it was created.
Yeah, I agree with that. I'm actually sort of torn on that whole blackened armor. Is it just the silver oxidation? Isn't it? Is it not? I need more information about that, to be perfectly honest. I just don't know. I don't know enough about that part. But it is something.
There's too much sunshine in the world for me to want to wear black armor in the first place. So I've never really invested too much into it, because I just want shiny. Like I want the quote white. Either that or painted something interesting. Actually, more likely, I'd rather do the actual like fitted tabard over my cuirass in the grand scheme of things. That's my end goal has always been to have some sort of fitted tabard over the top, so that it's really honestly not a big issue at all. But I've never invested too much into it, but it is an interesting conversation about the fact that things have changed over time, and not everything, and by things have, like the actual physical substances that were on the pages have altered through time. Time has had its effect on these things, but has it had the similar effect on all things in a manuscript page? Because there's lots of variables there.
Well, there's also that mindset of, you know, we think it looks cool. You know, it's like, oh man, that black armor, it looks so cool. And it can look cool. Doesn't necessarily mean that they thought it looked cool. Mm-hmm. So it's, like all things, sometimes there's nuance abides, as you said. That's our new slogan, everybody. Nuance abides.
Well, I think it's interesting that, at least in regards to blackened armor, some of the non-visual resources that I've seen used to justify black armor talks about it being the harness for the field. And so kind of it's like, it's the disposable stuff we wear into battle when we don't want to break the nice stuff. And so, like, again, that definitely goes back to the idea of, you know, just because it was there, does that mean everyone really adored black armor? Or was it stuff that you made en masse and handed out to the peasants so that they didn't die too quick? You know,
it's like when you're kids and, you know, you're going out to play in the mud and, you know, you just get back from church or something and you're like, I'm going to play with my friends here. And I was like, wear your black armor.
Yeah.
Change into your black armor before you go out into the battlefield.
You have a tournament in 6 days. We don't have time to send this off to the polishers.
Wear your black armor. Be home for lunch.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. It's true. It seems to reflect more accurately the circumstances than necessarily the idea that people would go out and adore black armor as some sort of ideal.
Wear your fake purple. I don't want you getting another fine.
Yeah, I like it though. Color's good.
Color is good, and I really do think. I think reenactors and living history people are doing a much better job at including color than Hollywood is. Hollywood still seems to be stuck on that. The medieval filter was that comic where it's like it's a bunch of happy, very colorful people in a medieval village, and you know they're like, okay, we're getting ready to roll, apply the medieval filter, and it's just a guy with a bucket of mud and he throws it over everything, and then suddenly everything looks blue and disease ridden. And
I know the comic you're talking about. It's one of those comics that does a lot of like medieval and LARP jokes, and they're really good. They have a series of ones where it's like the life of a reenactor and their armor. And it's like, their armor gets better and better, and then the last panel is them like just sitting outside their tent without armor on.
I think it's could be worse.
Could be worse, or no, more armor, where he's got piles of armor around.
The name of the comic, I'm pretty sure, is could be worse.
Let's see here.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is.
Yeah, I found them. Yeah, could be worse. Yeah, they're funny. I like it.
They're
one of those, they make the rounds a lot because they clearly get like us as a community, and they clearly are tapped into other communities as well, tangential to the medieval living history, but they definitely get it. They get it. It is funny. I like it a lot.
Yeah. So, yeah, but that's the medieval, like you said, but it's true though. It's the it all goes back to the old Monty Python, you know, the King Arthur. It's like, oh, how do you know he's king? He's the only one not covered in poop.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's like somehow Hollywood latched onto that idea, and it's like, oh, but except now everyone's covered in poop, even the king. If the king sets foot outside the castle, automatic poop. Just,
I guess. And I wonder if sometimes they get stuck in this because it's the signal that they have taught the audience to identify as a medieval film, and they're worried that people won't get it if they don't. So because we've seen movies that do it well, Outlaw King did color really well as Hollywood movies go, and that movie wasn't unsuccessful, but. Then you but have.
I think a lot of times, I think it just has to do with money, though. I mean, like, I think it just ends up being cheaper because it's like, look at that one of the most recent King Arthur ones where the guy was wearing basically like a sheepskin jacket, and it was absolutely ridiculous. It didn't even look medieval at all. It was just absolutely ridiculous. That was the
Well, there's also like when we're talking about sheepskin, you've got this the complaint about like the Vikings movie and the Last Kingdom and things like that.
Oh gosh.
But I just don't I guess I don't know how expensive wardrobes are, but I don't feel like a black t-shirt versus a red t-shirt versus a yellow t-shirt is any more expensive at Walmart, and I don't think they put their extras in pure linen and wool outfits. So at some point, is it really that much more expensive to buy cotton broadcloth in a color and make a tunic out of it for an extra, or even for a hero character, than it is to, I just don't think that currently, because they're not going to, the average medieval movie doesn't make a big deal about, oh, all of our clothes were dyed with medieval techniques. That was something super special for an incredibly art house type movie, you know, The Green Knight, which was focused much more on the art and the cinematography than the history. But bringing in the history helped enhance the art in this particular, and like in the aspect of his cloak. But I don't think the average movie cares whether or not they were dyed in a dyeing vat in Thailand versus dyed in a traditional, you know, pot on the stove by some medievalist. So I wonder how much more expensive that is, or whether or not they even consider that that's something that they should do in the first place. I wonder how often that idea is shot down or even brought up in the first place.
I think you might be onto something with that. Basically, and this actually comes from not a medieval movie, but it comes from the Zack Snyder's Superman movie, The Man of Steel.
Mm-hmm.
And when that came out, Superman's costume, while it still had the gold, you know, the big gold S and the red and the blue on it, it was very muted in its colors. It wasn't those bright jewel tones that, you know, Christopher Reeve wore or something like that. It was very, or even like from the TV shows of Superman, like Dean Cain's, Lois and Clark, like that. It was very sort of muted, darker blue and darker red and darker, you know, darker gold. And basically and people complained about it because they were like, you know, why would you do it? It made him so dour. It made him so, and it's like, well, the director's like, well, we didn't think anybody would, if they were bright colors, we didn't think anybody would take them seriously.
Right. And weren't they trying to aim for the whole much more gritty?
Yeah. Thing, like gritty.
Take things seriously. Batman noir-esque with the Superman take. Isn't that the whole concept, which a darker uniform makes sense for, but I can also see why people.
But I think that also, I think that might also go into the the medieval movies too. People, it's like they look at it like, well, if we have these bright jewel tones, nobody's gonna take it seriously. Mm-hmm. Except for us, we would, because we'd be like, oh my god, yes, finally. It's, I mean, are people really going to take Edward the First slaughtering the Scots seriously if he's wearing a pink tunic?
I mean, but why not? At some point. But
why not? At the same time, it's like
he's still doing the cool.
Like
he's still doing the, like, if you make the movie exciting enough and the cinematography is good and the fight choreography is good, he's still doing the cool stuff, right? And so why are people really going to get pulled that far out of it where they're like, oh, that's insane because he's wearing pink, but now it's like Bloodstained pink, so because he has killed a bunch of dudes, so like just, is it really, I don't know.
I'm sorry, I lost it when you said, well, I don't know if slaughtering a bunch of Scots is cool. But I would actually take it more seriously because it's showing, he was a rich and powerful on the cutting edge of style, so he wouldn't have just worn. It's like, the most recent, Timothée Chalamet, the King, which was basically the Agincourt movie that Netflix did, which was absolutely horrible, which we'll talk about later on a different episode. But anyway, they showed, or even the Henry V that I love, Branagh's version, his jupon is very muted. It's not that bright red and blue and the bright gold on it, when we know that it would have been bright, these bright, bright colors. And so I do wonder where that, it's like, they're like, oh, it's not serious enough, or it's not gritty enough if they're bright colors. It's like, their actions are gritty. Their actions are serious. They don't have to be. They're still going to be fashionable because they were the fashion leaders of their time. So, long story short, people wear bright colors.
They do. And I guess my biggest counterpoint to the whole idea of if they're dressed too garishly, will people not take them seriously? There are plenty of period films from eras where men would wear, like, silk cravats and lace, where they take the bad guys plenty seriously, even in something as I guess superficially period as the Pirates of the Caribbean movie. You have the, whatever his name was, the leader of the East India Company at the end of the trilogy, Cutler, character. Dressed like an aristocrat of his time, and he was still like the you should be scared of him proper villain, until they finally, everyone has to, you have to rally your entire main cast to defeat him at the end. Like, he was a legitimate bad guy, but he looked foppish, not because he was himself like a fop, but because he dressed according to his station. He was an aristocrat who was trying to, take over and put a stranglehold on the Caribbean. And so he would look like that. And it didn't detract from him being a powerful character. And I think audiences might be more accommodating than Hollywood gives them credit for. But then I think medieval movies and period flicks in general are probably riskier because they don't necessarily, it's harder to do a blockbuster. Like, Pirates of the Caribbean managed to make a blockbuster period film, but it also wasn't really a period film. It was a film set in a period. And so they're riskier movies. So I think they're probably less eager to do anything that might lower the amount of sales they get afterwards, because movie making is obviously at some point a business on top of an art.
True. That is very true. And when we make our decisions, for our impressions, we don't really have to bring in that business aspect of it. We can stick much more close to the historical ties than they did.
I like it.
Yeah. So, long story short, don't be afraid to wear bright colors. They wore them.
Wear colors. They're wonderful.
We love colors. Colors, colors, colors.
Colors are king.
Colors are king. And if you abide like the dude or Nuance, go give us five stars.
That's right. So we can continue
five stars
to abide episode by episode.
So we can continue to bring color to your life.
True. Because we feed on stars. They power our colors. Five stars only.
I'm so hungry otherwise for stars.
So yes. We're like Mario at the hard part of the level. Hungry for a star. Five stars.
Five stars.
Five stars. Star power.
And also, don't forget to check out Paul Butler's music.
Yeah, he was very gracious and allow us to use his music as part of our intro. You can find his albums and all his music at Paul Butler's Music. The link will be included below. If you have anything you want to tell us about color and how much you love it, you can always send those in as an email, howtomedieval@gmail.com. That's howtomedieval@gmail.com. We also will put your sound bites up on the episode if you send us in a recording of something a comment, a question, something that you want to add to the show, we'll bring it in. And obviously, we love hearing your comments on Facebook as well. We'll respond to them there in real time.
That's right. Always respond to them.
Thanks, everybody, for listening. Oh, go ahead.
Yes, I was going to say, if there's any show topics that you want to hear, let us know. We want to put out the content that you want to listen to. So let us know. We'll be happy to look into it.
Absolutely. We have anyone who submits and suggests an episode that we do right on, we'll definitely credit you with the inspiration. If you have anything to link to, we'll make sure as well to get that into the show notes as well.
All right. Thanks for listening, folks.